Welcome to the podcast On Things Above, a weekly discussion and devotion rooted in the Word of God and reaching toward heaven above. Hello and welcome back to On Things Above. Today, another member from Southside is with us, Brandon Starling, and he's chosen to talk about the faith of David. So, Brandon, tell us how things are going for the Starling family. And tell us about what stood out to you about the faith of David.
Well, things are going really well for us. We have a lot to be thankful for. On April 10th, we added Andrew David to our family. And over the last few weeks, I've actually gotten really busy with work, so that's been good. And that means that for most of the day, Jennifer is juggling a newborn and a two-year-old who wants to be out and about, all while being confined at home. And so I don't know how she's doing it, but she's doing an amazing job of that, and all with no sleep, of course. But like a lot of your previous guests have mentioned, you know, these times have allowed us to take advantage of some opportunities that we probably wouldn't have otherwise. You know, for example, it's become a daily tradition for Jonathan and I to take walks around the neighborhood. And then for me, another thing, honestly, has been this podcast. And, you know, these people in Hebrews 11 are so familiar to us, but I felt like each episode and each guest, you know, you've been able to bring something out that either I hadn't thought of before or that was just especially timely. And so I know this has had to be, have been a lot of extra work on you two. But so I just wanted to say thanks, and I've gotten a lot of good out of it.
Thank you, Brandon. It's been very hard to see Jonathan sitting with you there at services the last 2 weeks, and not being able to go grab him and pick him up and walk around. I've missed my little buddy.
Yeah, he, you can tell he's just kind of confused, you know, about what's going on. Everyone's got the mask, and he's not hugging anybody. And so we have been thankful to be back, but we're ready for the time that we can do it without having the social distance.
Absolutely.
Tell us more about why you chose David.
Well, so each person that made this Hall of Faith, you know, that's listed in Hebrews 11, they did so because each of them in their own way demonstrated what great faith in God is. And when I think of the concept of greatness, it's hard to think of anybody in the Old Testament who fits that description better than David. And you look at Hebrews 11, verses 33 and 34, and that's when the writer is running out of time. And so he just lists a whole bunch of things that people had done through faith in the Bible. And a lot of the men and the women in the Bible who were faithful accomplished one or two of these things. But it's amazing to me how many of these feats could be attributed to David. Just starting in verse 33, David conquered kingdoms. He enforced justice. He obtained promises. And of course, you know, you've already attributed stop the mouths of lions to Daniel, but as a young shepherd boy, whenever lions threatened his flock, David killed them. And, you know, he escaped the edge of the sword for years, hiding in caves while, you know, King Saul was obsessed with murdering him. And through his faith, he was made strong out of those moments of weakness. And then certainly David fits the last two phrases. He became strong in war and put foreign armies to flight, so much so that the Israelite women sang about it. You know, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. And so, you know, we use the phrase sometimes, that's my kind of guy. And that's basically what God said about David. God called him a man after my own heart. And so I guess you could say there are a lot of reasons why I chose David.
Well, let's get into the narrative then over in 1 Samuel 17 and learn more about the man after God's own heart.
Okay, so one of the things that David was exceptional in was his faith in God's power. And so I just want to start reading 1 Samuel 17, verse 1. It says, "Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Socoh, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Socoh and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with the valley between them. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits in a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs, and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. And his shield bearer went before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, 'Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves, and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us.' And the Philistine said, 'I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together.' When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid." And then verse 16, "For 40 days, the Philistine came forward and took his stand morning and evening." So it says Goliath's height was 6 cubits in a span, which is about 9 feet, 9 inches tall. There's a photo of it. It's pretty easy to find online. It was taken from Super Bowl 51 at NRG Stadium. And it's Shaquille O'Neal standing next to Olympic gymnast Simone Biles. And it is just hilarious to look at that photo and to see the just unbelievable difference in their sizes. For those who might not know, Shaq is 7'1", while Simone Biles is 4'8". But if you look at that photo, it probably gives you at least a pretty good idea of what David and Goliath must have looked like next to each other. And then there's Goliath's equipment. When I was I grew up playing baseball, and one of the things that batters do sometimes when they're warming up is they use what's called a donut. And it's just this little ring that you put on the end of your bat. And it weighs about 1 pound, typically. But it makes a huge difference. You know, when you try to swing that bat with that 1 pound ring on the end, it feels like you're swinging through water, you know. And of course, it's supposed to help you improve your bat speed. But the text says Goliath's spearhead weighed 600 shekels. That's over 15 pounds of iron on the tip of his spear. And so, you know, for a typical soldier, that's going to be difficult just to hold level for any length of time, much less wield in battle. And then, you know, lately, during the rare times that I've had to venture out, you know, among the public for work or to get supplies, and I'm wearing my mask, you know, I find myself thinking about how cumbersome this mask is. You know, it's hot, it's uncomfortable, it's just such a burden to have this thin piece of cloth over my face. And meanwhile, Goliath is covered in bronze armor, you know, from his legs up to his head. And it says that his mail coat alone weighed 5,000 shekels. That's a 126-pound coat that he's wearing in battle. And so he was just a monster of a man. And just reading about him, I know I can't fully appreciate how powerful he must have been, or how utterly, you know, intimidating it must have been to be near him in person. And for 40 days, morning and evening, he issues this challenge, and nobody in Israel accepts it. Surprisingly to me, since he's a favorite of mine, not even Jonathan. The text says that they were all too afraid. Now, of course, David was not there. David was the youngest of 8 brothers, and so he's back home in Bethlehem tending his father's sheep. But his dad sends him to the battle with some food for his brothers, and because he must have been a pretty smart guy, some cheeses for their commander. And he tells David to find out how the battle is going. And so verse 22 says, "And David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. As he talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before, and David heard him." Verse 26, "And David said to the men who stood by him, 'What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?'" So even as a youth, David recognized that by defying Israel, Goliath was essentially defying God himself. And he has this indignant reaction, and it reminds me of when I was a kid on the playground, and one of the other boys would declare, "My dad could beat up your dad." And, you know, that was worse than "you're not coming to my birthday party." Because, you know, especially as a young boy, you tend to have absolute faith in your dad. There's nothing dad can't fix. There's nothing dad can't do. And that's the kind of faith that David had in God his whole life. And he wasn't going to stand by and let anybody insult God's army like that. I know for myself, at least, one of the reasons that I sometimes fail to speak up for God when I should is because I allow myself to think that people don't want to hear it. You know, people don't want to change. They don't want to be told they need to repent and put their faith in God. And if David was here, he would say, "So what?" You know, his own brother got angry at his words, and King Saul patronized him. But he didn't let their negative responses discourage him. He tells Saul, you know, "Look, as a shepherd, with God's help, I've already killed bears and lions." You know, plural, by the way, as if that's no big deal. And he says, "God will make this Philistine just like one of them." And so Saul gives David his blessing. And after declining to use Saul's armor and sword, he takes his staff, sling, and 5 stones, and he goes out to meet Goliath. And then verse 41, "And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine said to David, 'Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?' And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, 'Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field.'" So we hear this a phrase used sometimes. This is a real David versus Goliath contest or matchup. And in the sports world, what people mean when they say that is that two very unevenly matched teams are about to play each other. And so the Goliath team is stronger, they're faster, they're more talented, they're better coached, they're better equipped than the David team. And 999,999 times out of a million, the Goliath is going to win. And, you know, we like to root for those one in a million upsets. But the ironic thing is, David and Goliath wasn't a David and Goliath story. David knew through faith that with God on his side, Goliath was nothing. David beating Goliath was not an upset. He knew that Goliath had no chance against the power of God, even if nobody else knew that. And then verse 45, "Then David said to the Philistine, 'You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand.' When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. I've noticed that part is missing out of all of Jonathan and Andrew's picture Bibles. And when the Philistines saw what their champion was dead, they fled. And the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and as the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Sherem as far as Gath and Ekron. I like that last verse because it shows that once David put his faith in action, pardon the expression, his faith was contagious. And all of these men who had been trembling for the last 40 days, all of a sudden, you know, they too are these courageous warriors. And so it just made me think about during these times, you know, when people ask me, how's it going? You know, how's the real estate market? Are you worried? And I can choose to respond in faith and not know what kind of impact my faith can have on the people around me.
It's a song that I've been listening to since quarantine started. It's a group, or it's by a group called Praise and Harmony, that some people might be familiar with it. But the hymn is entitled Every Giant Will Fall. And the chorus says, every giant will fall, the mountains will move, every chain of the past you've broken into, over fear, over lies, we're singing your truth, that nothing is impossible for you. And that's exactly the faith that David showed throughout his life, that with God, all things are possible, whether it's literal or metaphorical giants, every giant will fall. But while we see David, the giant slayer, here in chapter 17, if we back up just one chapter, we read about sort of where his faith began, out in the pasture as David the shepherd.
Well, there's a song that usually is sung during vacation Bible school or the kids' classes called Only a Little Boy David. And when you just go with the lyrics of the song, you might get the impression that it was only a little boy David versus this giant. Now, my point is not that VBS is teaching false doctrine, but it wasn't just a little boy David who went into battle that day. It wasn't just a little boy David who had confidence when the army of Israel was shrunk in fear. We find in 1 Samuel 16 that David had something that distinguished him from not just the other sons of Jesse, but from all the warriors of Israel. He's introduced to us, and several things are said about him in verse 18 of 1 Samuel 16. He was a skillful musician, a mighty man of valor, a warrior, one prudent in speech, and a handsome man. And the Bible is usually pretty stingy about details, at least physical details of people. Up in verse 12, we find that he was ruddy with beautiful eyes and handsome in appearance. And we might get caught up in all of those things and think all of those things are important. But look at the last phrase that is mentioned about David in verse 18. And the Lord is with him. That's what transformed him, where he was no longer only a little boy, David. The Lord was with him. We read in verse 13 that the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. So the reason David could slay the giant and do what no other warrior could do, the reason David became mighty in war, was because the Lord was with him. And the Spirit of the Lord was upon him. Brandon, there's a reason that we've chosen the name David to be in both of our sons. He was a man after God's own heart, and we hope that for our sons as well. But if we're ever going to defeat some besetting sin or slay the giant that's before us in our life, whether that's some addiction or some problem that we can't overcome. If we're ever going to get past that, it will only be because the Lord is with us, and He is stronger than what we're fighting, and He will enable us to become mighty in war as He did for only a little boy, David.
When I was a senior at Dry Creek Camp, we went outside one night and we were doing what we call star tipping. It's where you stare up at a star and you spin around for, I think, like 15 seconds, then you chase a light. But after we did all that, we finally settled down and we're just looking up at the night sky. And it was just silent, thinking about all the lessons that we had talked about throughout the week. And the next day in Bible class, I remember, Bubba, you made the point that David, as he's that shepherd boy out in the pasture, was staring up at the same night sky that we see, that he looks up and sees the same constellations that we look at. And the point in that is that he's not unlike us. He goes through he lives in the same world. He goes through the similar things that we do. And I think that's important to remember, because it points out that David, he wasn't always the giant slayer. He wasn't always the poetic psalmist. He wasn't always the brave shepherd. He had moments of weakness just like all of us. And that comes out several times throughout the story. So Brandon, let's look at some of those as we see God's grace outshine David's weaknesses.
Yeah. So like you said, Jarrett, he achieved greatness in ways that I'll never match, but he was also relatable and he was flawed and he did struggle throughout his life with a variety of sins. So for example, in 1 Samuel 25, David and his men had been camping out amongst the laborers of a man named Nabal. And Nabal is described as both rich and worthless. And they had protected Nabal's workers and his livestock and his produce for a whole season. And David sends some messengers to Nabal to ask him to provide them with some food. And Nabal's response is basically, "David who?" And he returns David's goodness with insults. And so when his messengers come back to him and tell him about this, he gives a very cool, calm, and measured response of, "Every man strap on his sword." And, you know, to be fair, how many of us haven't said that a time or two at some point? But he intended to kill not only Nabal, but he says every male who is with him. And then another time, David sinned from just carelessness in regards to God's authority. When they went to move the Ark of the Covenant in 1 Chronicles 13, David had a new cart constructed so that the ark could be pulled by oxen, which was not the way God had instructed him to move the ark in the law of Moses. And as a result of his carelessness, the oxen stumbled. Uzzah puts his hand on the ark to steady it, and God strikes Uzzah dead. And then in 1 Chronicles 21 and 2 Samuel 24, we have the account of a census that David ordered. And the text says that Satan was the one that put this thought into his heart and tempted him to do this. And it appears that David went along with it out of pride. He wanted to show how great, you know, he and Israel had become by numbering the people as if their numbers had ever been their source of strength. Even Joab and the commanders, they tried to talk sense to him. They said, "David, are you sure you want to do this? This is not a good idea." But David was stubborn and his word prevailed over them. They numbered the people. And then God strikes Israel afterward. And so, we see that throughout his life, he struggled with sins like vengeance and rashness, anger, carelessness, pride, stubbornness. And Bubba, you mentioned in a previous episode how throughout the centuries after David, until Babylon conquered Jerusalem, the reign of each king that followed his was summed up by one of two phrases. Either he walked in the ways of his father David, or he did not walk in the ways of his father David. And so what was it that distinguished David? It wasn't that his reign as king was flawless, you know, far from it. It wasn't that he was above sin. What set him apart from King Saul before him and from so many of the kings after him was how he always responded to his own sin. And so in the case of Nabal, it was that man's wife, Abigail, who hurried to David in secret and pleaded with him to show mercy. And in 1 Samuel 25:32, and David said to Abigail, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you to me this day. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you, who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand." And in regards to Uzzah's death, in 1 Chronicles 15, David gathers this time, when it's time to move the ark again, he gathers the Levites and the priests, and in verse 12 he says, "You are the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites. Consecrate yourselves, you and your brothers, so that you may bring up the ark of the Lord, the God of Israel, to the place that I have prepared for it. Because you did not carry it the first time, the Lord our God broke out against us, because we did not seek him according to the rule." So the priests and the Levites consecrated themselves to bring up the ark of the Lord, the God of Israel. And the Levites carried the ark of God on their shoulders with the poles, as Moses had commanded, according to the word of the Lord. And then right after his census is completed, in 2 Samuel 24, verse 10 says, "But David's heart struck him after he had numbered the people. And David said to the Lord, 'I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly.'" And so each time after David's sin, we see that he's willing to confess his sin. He takes responsibility for what he did, and he repents and he makes it right. And that is what distinguished him from so many other people in the Old Testament. And that's what makes him a man after God's own heart. And then there's 2 Samuel 11 and David's worst sin of all. And we know he's standing on a rooftop. He sees a woman bathing, and instead of looking away, he lusts after her, and then he inquires about her. And they tell him, "Is this not Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Well, Uriah was a soldier off to war, and not just any soldier. We're told that he was one of David's mighty men. He was one of an elite group of 30 warriors who had fought valiantly for David. And still, David sins for her, and he commits adultery with her. And as if that wasn't betrayal enough, then, to hide his sin, he ultimately ends up conspiring to murder Uriah. He has him put on the front lines of battle, and he secretly instructs Joab to pull everyone else back away from him so that he's killed. And it's natural, after reading 2 Samuel 11, to ask, how could he have done this? You know, and the truth is, I don't have a good answer for that. I don't really understand how David could have done this, how he could have behaved so selfishly, so wickedly. I can guess some of the things that might have been going through his mind, but I really don't understand how he could have done this. But a better question is, how could David have ever been redeemed from a sin like that? Mm-hmm. And I do know the answer to that, and it's through faith. As evil as his sin was, David had absolute faith that God's mercy and his grace was greater than his sin. And when he confessed his sin and when he asked God to forgive him, he was 100% confident that God could and God would forgive him and cleanse him of that sin. And it was his faith that delivered him from his sin. I'll never forget one Friday night Bible study in College Station, just before Thanksgiving break. And the guy teaching asked the class for volunteers, you know, who'd like to share something they were thankful for. And one of the girls raised her hand and said, "I'm thankful for time." And that's kind of a vague statement. And so the teacher asked her, you know, to explain, "What do you mean by that?" And she said, "I'm thankful for the time God gave me to repent." And that really hit close to home for me. And so maybe David's faith is just a reminder, you know, through all of these stressful times of uncertainty and anger and sadness for a variety of reasons in our country and around the world right now, maybe David's faith is a reminder of just the simple blessing that we have in Jesus Christ of forgiveness and mercy and grace. And when we put our faith in Jesus, in his gospel, the way that David put his faith in God, then no matter what happens around us, we can have peace from that knowledge.
I think David says it himself in such a powerful way in Psalm 51. There we know he reflects back on this moment of weakness, probably his greatest moment of weakness there with his sin with Bathsheba. And he says, "Have mercy on me, O God, according to your steadfast love." So what David calls to his defense is not the other righteous deeds that he had done. It's not, hey, remember when I slayed the giant, or remember the good that I did in times past, or how I brought the ark into Jerusalem, or any of those things. He doesn't call upon his own righteousness. He calls to his defense God's own goodwill and nature and his grace, according to your loving kindness. And that should be our plea as well. We appeal not to our own deeds, not to the good that we have done, as if it could outweigh the bad, but to God's amazing grace that's greater than all our sin. And Bubba, that was something that the Corinthians had to learn in Paul's first letter. So let's turn over there to 1 Corinthians 6.
Okay, so the New American Standard Bible gives headings to each of the chapters. And when you come to 2 Samuel 11, it just simply says David's great sin. And we've all either felt this way, or we have met someone in studying the Bible with them who feels that their sin is so great that either I can't be saved, or if you're already a Christian, I can't be used. This is the death sentence for my usefulness in the kingdom. Well, Paul wrote to a group of people in Corinth who had in their past been things like fornicators, adulterers, effeminate, homosexuals, idolaters, thieves, covetous, swindlers, drunkards, and revilers. Now, he says in 1 Corinthians 6, 9, and 10 that those who practice such things cannot inherit the kingdom of God. But then in verse 11, he says, "Such were some of you, some of my brethren, brothers and sisters of the church in Corinth, such were some of you. You committed these great sins. But what happened? You were washed. You were sanctified. You were justified." When he says you were washed, they were made clean, just like when Saul washed away his sins. When they were sanctified, they were made holy. Now God had equipped them and made them useful, set apart for service. When they were justified, they were made right. God pronounced them not guilty of the sins for which they've committed, because he would remember them no more. Let us not think that great sin cannot be overcome, because God's grace is greater.
Well, there's one more major event in David's life that we didn't quite get to, and it might be the most significant of all, and that's because it directly affects us today. In 2 Samuel 7 in verse 2, David says, "I live in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells in a tent." And so David, he desires to build a house for God there in Jerusalem. And the Lord said that while he wouldn't be the one to do it, his son would come along and finish the work after him. But because of David's heart, because of his love for God and wanting to build this house and wanting to do this thing for him, God makes a covenant with them. And he says there in 2 Samuel 7 and verse 8, "I took you from the pasture, from tending the flock, and appointed you ruler over my people, Israel. I've been with you wherever you've gone, and I've cut off all your enemies from before you. Now I'll make your name great, like the names of the greatest men on earth, and I'll provide a place for my people, the Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I'll raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I'll establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I'll establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son, and my love will never be taken away from him. Your throne will be established forever. And I love David's response. He says, O Lord God, who am I? That covenant, the promise of a king that would come from David, would of course ultimately be fulfilled in Jesus, the greater David. He would be the true shepherd of our souls, the one who conquers our giants, the one who made grace possible through his perfect life and sacrifice. And he's the one who built the ultimate house and dwelling place of God, that is the church. And as we live as citizens of this greater kingdom, all we can say is, like David, who am I? Brandon, thanks again for joining us today and for those good thoughts on the faith of David.
Thank you guys for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Bubba, who's up next?
We're excited to welcome back to Southside David Curry, and he has chosen by faith Enoch. We look forward to hearing David.
Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.